Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. On this week's episode, we're listening to voices from Indiana Tech's Tech Talk series on the opioid crisis. Before continuing, a word of warning that as we delve into topics of drug use, addiction, and overdoses, some of the content for the rest of our show may be hard to hear. The next presenter in our program will be Katie Parrish, an assistant professor of special education at Indiana Tech. Thank you for listening.
So to prepare for today, I read an article that was published in Education Weekly this past month, and I wanted to provide you with some of those statistics. So in 2012, one baby was born every 25 minutes with what they're calling neonatal abstinence syndrome, which is the term used to define babies who are born with exposure to opioids. Those rates have increased five times from 2000 to 2013. And just knowing that it's now 2018 and the CDC, the most recent data we have is from 2012, so you can imagine what those numbers would look like today. So I want to talk a little bit about what this means for schools. So let's just say there's a cure for the opioid crisis within the next year, 2 years. What we're left with is this huge population of children who are now going to be school-aged, who were born with exposure to opioids, who are now in the school system for the next 20 years. So when you think about the lasting effects of what's going on today, it's going to be here for a long time. Babies who are born with exposure to opioids are more likely to be identified to need special education services for exceptionalities like autism, developmentally delayed, specific learning disabilities, other health impairments, and also speech and language impairments. There's also an increased number of children who are displaced from their home, living with elderly grandparents, and also entering the foster care system because their parents have either been, you know, in jail for the use of illegal use of opioids. School districts are also starting to employ full-time social workers and then also implement trauma-informed practices. And this is just a trend that's gonna increase over the next several years. Some legislative changes impacting schools right now are many states are providing school nurses with training and the authority to administer Narcan. That's probably more in the high school settings, but they do have the authority to administer those to students. And then also states are requiring districts to include opioid abuse education in their health curriculum. And then I just wanted to share a personal story from my experience. A few years ago, I was tutoring twin sisters who were six years old in the summertime. And the mom dropped them off to tutoring one day, and she was really concerned about what they were doing when they were with their dad, who they were divorced. So on visitations with the dad, the girls were able to communicate to the mom, and there was some drug activity and things like that going on. Well, the mom reported that to Children's Services, but for whatever reason, it was disregarded. So she just, you know, kind of showed her concern to me and said, you know, is there anything you can do? Can you talk to the girls, see if you can get any information? So during our tutoring session that day, I just asked the girls to draw a picture of what they do when they go to visit their dad and where do you guys go, who do you see, different things like that. What I ended up with was a picture, and they both had drawn the same thing almost, was a picture with two vehicles. The girls were in the back seat, and there was two men in the front seat, and they had their arms out the window. And then there was a picture of a needle, and then just trees and other things that kids would draw in a picture. So after that, I started asking them questions. Can you describe this to me? Tell me what you do. Tell me the story that goes on with this. And as they were talking to me, I was writing down what they were saying, and I was also labeling the picture. And the story that they were telling me was, we go to other towns with our dad, and we pull up to his friends. We see his friends in other cars, and they both stick their hands out the window, so they're exchanging the drugs there. And then we go to a restaurant or go get, you know, food or park, and daddy tells us to look away, and he puts something in his arm. He puts the needle in his arm. So the dad was using with the children in the car. So what I was able to do was communicate that to my administrator, and then we made the report to Children's Services. The next day, Children's Services was at the dad's house requiring him to take a drug test or else lose visitation rights. He obviously refused, and then the dad was found 2 weeks later. He overdosed in his car and was found dead. So the message of that kind of story is as you all, you know, graduate and are working with children, or individuals under 18 is we're mandated reporters, and we have to take that responsibility very seriously, because, you know, parents are entrusting their children's lives with us. And we, when we suspect abuse or when we suspect things like that, it really is our job to advocate and not necessarily investigate and dig into something that we don't know is there. But when we have reports and we have evidence or we suspect things like that, it really is our responsibility to talk to the children and get that story out so we can report that and make sure they're protected.
That was Katie Parrish, Assistant Professor of Special Education at Indiana Tech. The next person we're going to hear from this hour is Dr. Justin Boyce. He is a professor of psychology, and he'll begin his talk with some history of opioids, before also examining dependence and withdrawal. Thank you for listening to WBOI Presents.
So as I was preparing for this presentation, I started to think, how did we get here? How did we get to a place where we have an opium addiction? And so I decided to do a little bit of research to get a better understanding of what was going on. And one of the things that most of us, well, most of you probably recognize, is opium is not new. It's been around for a long time. In fact, it first presented itself back in 3400 BC and was originally found in Southwest Asia. And even the ancient Greeks, the Romans used it. It was used for pain relieving qualities. At that time, they smoked it. Eventually, opium came to the United States. By the 1800s, we had the gold rush. And so we had Chinese workers immigrating into the United States to work on the railroad system. And they brought it in and started to use it. At that time, we saw what were known as drug dens develop from the West Coast in California over to the East Coast in New York. And it was probably somewhere in the early 1800s that it began to be used sort of in a medicinal way. So originally it was used sort of recreationally and eventually became a legitimate medicine and was prescribed for specifically pain relief. One of the earliest opiates was heroin. Everybody's familiar with heroin. And heroin became illegal by 1920s because of its really powerful addiction. As a consequence, we had several medicines developed. For example, we had morphine. So morphine was developed, again, for medicinal purposes. It was used as a pain reliever for severe pain. We had codeine developed. That was prescribed for moderate levels of pain. And then eventually oxycodone was developed. Now, oxycodone was a little bit interesting because people began to crush the oxycodone and snort the oxycodone, or they would dissolve it in water and then use it intravenously. Pharmaceutical companies developed it to deal with medicine. There was an acknowledgement that heroin was addictive, but yet we proceeded to, you know, to use these drugs, despite the very clear evidence of their high addictive qualities. At some point, we had the development of methadone, and some of you may have heard about the methadone clinic. So methadone clinics were developed as a treatment, if you will, for people that were addicted to opiates, particularly morphine, codeine, and oxycodone. The interesting thing about the methadone was that it, too, was very addictive. It hit the system a little bit more slowly. It got dissolved by your stomach acids and eventually went into the bloodstream. And so it did not create as much of a rush, but it still created a level of addiction. So here we are in 2018 with a significant addiction ongoing. And it has hit now, in the past it was used sort of illegally, became legal, and is now being prescribed in many households. Like how many of us have used a cold medicine with codeine? So think about that. So that's an opiate. The problem becomes when people become addicted. So what causes addiction? So the person starts taking this medicine pretty innocently. Perhaps it's being prescribed for pain. Most of the opiates were described for severe or moderate pain. Eventually, the pain, so you take it, the pain goes away, you feel great. And then over time, and for some people very rapidly, they start taking this medicine much more quickly. And so it's being prescribed to take maybe once in the morning, once at night. Now we have the person taking the medicine several times during the course of the day. And so over the course of the day, they are becoming dependent on the drug and have developed an addiction. And so each time they take the drug more frequently and they take the drug in a way that it was not prescribed, they develop a tolerance. So you need to take more and more of this medicine for it to have an effect. And so the person over time starts taking this drug more frequently, more of it, larger amounts, and perhaps they even change the way. So maybe they were swallowing it as pills or drinking the suspension. Now they're crushing and snorting it, or they're using it intravenously. And aha, suddenly we have an addiction. And this is your Aunt Susie. So Aunt Susie, who is a secretary in an office, is suddenly addicted to a substance that was prescribed to her legally. So it was not an illegal drug. She got this drug prescribed to her legally. And so we have an addiction. Now, in our brains, we have what we call endorphin receptors. And so what happens is when a person takes any one of the opiates, those opiates will attach to those receptors in the brain. And your endorphins, as you probably remember from Intro to Psych, Abnormal Psych, are sort of those feel-good transmitters. And so the person replaces those natural feel-goods with these synthetic or, in this instance, these substances. Now, in terms of the workplace, what happens when you are at work, you may have limited ability to use a substance. And so some people might experience periods of withdrawal. And when they begin to experience periods of withdrawal, they may experience some anxiety, some depression, they may have diarrhea, and so on. And they spend a fair amount of time craving the next use of the drug. So the other things, I was looking at the research to see, well, what were some of the effects from a psychological standpoint in terms of how it affected people on the job? Well, it affected your ability to attend to your job. So if your job is working on a factory line where you're moving specific products that need to be very precisely and carefully dealt with, or you're operating heavy equipment, or your job involves driving or interacting with people, your ability to be attentive is reduced. Okay? People will have difficulty with recall. So they have difficulty remembering procedures and protocols that they otherwise would need to follow. They would have issues with visuospatial skills. What are visuospatial skills? So that's your ability to discern the space in front of you and how you negotiate through that space. So again, if you're operating equipment, you're going to have an issue. Psychomotor speed. There were several studies in which they looked at people using opiates and found that initially, if they use small amounts, it really did not affect their perceptual or psychomotor speed, how quickly they were able to get things done. But as they increased the amounts of opiates that they were taking, and as they took opiates over a long period of time, psychomotor speed was negatively impacting. Use of opiates also affects your cognitive functioning. And so we have what's known as your frontal lobe. And the frontal lobe, you have your executive functioning. So that's your ability to plan. That's your ability to engage in critical thinking, your ability to make informed decisions and organize facts. And those things are compromised. I first became aware of opiates probably sometime in the early 2000s. I was working, providing direct mental health care. And I had a particular patient, a male, somewhere in his 50s, and he had a PTSD diagnosis. And over time, I became aware, as he became aware, of his addiction to opiates, particularly oxycodone. And what was happening, the first time it came up, he was, you know, Dr. Boyce, I need your help. And so, like, well, how can I help you? He says, well, I'm taking this medicine for pain, because he had significant body pain, which was probably legitimate. He had had an injury. And he said, my car got broken into and the person stole my bag of medicines. And so, of course, you know, trying to be the good helper, I got in touch with the pharmacy and we made arrangements for him to get these reissued. The next week he comes back again, yet a very similar story. his car is broken into again. And I'm like, wow, what, you know, what kind of luck do you have? And this time I was smart enough to say, well, where's your police report? Well, and, you know, he had some excuses, did not have a police report. A couple of weeks later, it was my cat. My cat jumped on the counter, dropped the pills into the zinc, and so forth. And I was like, okay, let's stop. Let's step back and look at what's going on. It seems to me that you have an addiction. And so we spent a fair amount of time exploring that addiction. He was a really good guy, a really nice guy. And so this happens to good people. This happens to moms and dads, brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles. So this is not just the boogeyman or the guy on the side of the street who is a drug dealer. These are innocent civilians, our friends, our relatives, you know, our clients, the people that serve us at the grocery store. And so this is affecting a lot of people. So we've made this natural assumption that only bad people use drugs. And again, the difference between opiates and, let's say, marijuana or crack cocaine or one of the other substances is that these are legal drugs. These are drugs that are being prescribed to folks for medical conditions, particularly conditions that involve significant pain. And so I think it's very difficult for people. And I think the people that started taking the medicine took them really very innocently. They went in, they had some pain. And in some instances, we have to fault medicine, because oftentimes prescribers are at times very heavy-handed. I've gone in for dental procedures and I'm quite satisfied taking my Tylenol. The dentist says, well, you really might need this oxycodone. And I'm like, no, thank you. I don't want that. I know where that stuff goes. I'll just take the Tylenol. And so sometimes there is this looseness about prescribing. I think it came from a good place. Certainly nobody in pharmacy developed these things thinking that they would become a national problem. But we did know. I mean, we knew from the 1800s that heroin, which comes from, you know, opiates, was highly addictive. But yet we prescribe these things. So I think people are just having a difficult time equating it with grandma. You know, they think it's the boogeyman or the drug guy on the corner. And so, but that's not the case.
That was Dr. Justin Boyce from Indiana Tech as part of their Tech Talk series on the opioid crisis. Thank you for listening to WBOI Presents.